Our subject tonight is certainly a controversial one. If there's a loving God, why is there so much suffering? It's a problem that's bothered quite a few throughout history. Some have been bothered by it theoretically, both just on the merits of the philosophical, theological question of how this can be, and some theoretically because they've never practically experienced much in the way of suffering. People have been blessed by growing up in a situation, growing up in a country, family, etc., where they've not had much suffering. But it's also a very practical question for many people. Some people have grown up in a family where there's been a great deal of suffering, or in a country where there's been a great deal of suffering, or have belonged to a people group that have suffered a great deal. I've heard many references to the fact that there were many Jews during World War II who lost their faith in the existence of God because of the disasters of the Holocaust. And the article on atheism in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy really makes this the chief argument against God's existence. If there is a loving God, why is there so much suffering? Now, if we've learned anything from science in this century, it's that this universe is rather more unusual than we thought it was. That many of our a priori, common sense, seat-of-the-pants type judgments of how things ought to be are wrong. And as we look at evidence regarding how things are, they're a little more peculiar than we thought they were. So we generally have not much thought about the idea that space, that time might be relative, that space might be curved, that reality might be put together in such a strange way that it's hard to say whether an electron is a particle or a wave. And if you say it's sort of both, it's hard to understand that too. Well, it may be that there's some strange things like that in other parts of reality as well. In this talk this evening, I propose to examine this question, if there's a loving God, why is there so much suffering? By breaking it down into a series of questions. First question I'd like to address is there a God? Next, I'd like to answer the question, is he the God of the Bible? Thirdly, I'd like to ask, is he loving? Fourthly, why then is there suffering? And lastly, why is there so much suffering? First of all, is there a God? This is obviously a question on which there's considerable difference of opinion among people here and throughout the world. And yet, there is some very strong evidence that points to the existence of God. This evidence comes, first of all, from the nature of our universe as a whole, which suggests that we live in a created universe. When I was in graduate school doing doctoral work in astrophysics, the major theory, or one of the major theories regarding the nature of the universe, was the so-called steady-state theory of the universe, that our universe had always existed, was infinitely large, and new matter was popping into existence everywhere in the universe at a small rate, but just at such a rate as to keep the universe expanding, replace the old matter with new matter and such, and that's the way the universe was. While I was in graduate school, some evidence began to crop up that threw that very much seriously into question. Certain evidences began to arise to suggest that no, our universe was not having matter popping into it at just the right rate to give it the same density at all times in history while the universe continued to expand, but rather that back in earlier in the universe's history, the universe was very crowded with matter and has been expanding and thinning down ever since, so that if any matter is being popping into existence, it's popping into existence at a far smaller rate than that necessary to keep the density of the universe the same. A number of cosmologists, going with this Big Bang theory of the universe, that there was a very dense, hot state some 10 to 20 billion years ago, still sought to avoid that as being the creation event by suggesting that our universe was something like an accordion. Expands, contracts, with perhaps a time sequence of perhaps 100 billion years or something like that. Carl Sagan, in his famous TV series Cosmos, in fact, leans in that direction, suggests that the ancient Hindu idea of a conflagration every so many years, actually quite a few more than every 100 billion years in Hindu theology, definitely felt that something of that sort was the way to go. But recent investigations have shown some very serious problem with getting around a universe that has a beginning. The idea of a collapsing universe that would then bounce and expand again has run into the problem that all of the calculations we can do with our knowledge of general relativity, gravitation, and such would suggest that a collapsing universe that reached the kind of densities that would be characteristic of the Big Bang should have pulled itself into a black hole and quit rather than coming back out again. And we are not in some such state as that. We're certainly an expanding universe. That has led many, many cosmologists in just the last 5 years to suggest that indeed there was an absolute beginning of some sort about 10 to 20 billion years ago at the Big Bang. As best I can tell, reading some of the literature, there are people who want to avoid a creation by saying the universe popped into existence out of nothing. It is uncaused, just, and there it was. Not sure whether it made that noise or not, but that basically was the idea. And yet the evidence has continued to accumulate that we have a universe that has a beginning. Lo and behold, that points very strongly to a beginner, a creator. Particularly when you consider that our universe is not just a mess of chaos. Our universe is very, very carefully designed. Now, our universe doesn't look designed on certain levels. For instance, if you can imagine what's going on in the gas floating around us here in the air, as far as we can tell, that looks pretty chaotic. There are oxygen molecules and nitrogen molecules and a few neon and other molecules bouncing around at rather chaotic different speeds and different directions, and that can be represented by some sort of statistical representation. And it's true, when you look out in space, although clearly there are laws operating that the planets go around our sun in ways that we can calculate and more or less predict where they're going to be and things of that sort, yet the real design that we see in our universe comes when we begin to look at the, as far as we know, the four basic laws of force in our universe. The gravitational interaction, the weakest of the four, the strong nuclear force, the strongest of the four, the electromagnetic force, the second strongest, and the weak nuclear interaction, the third strongest of the four. It turns out that there are a number of very finely tuned balances between these forces that if you did any diddling with them, in many cases 5% messing with them, you would not have any kind of universe that could support life. And in a few of the cases, you can't mess with them that much. For instance, the balance between positive and negative charges in the universe is so close to being exactly the same that electromagnetic force cancels out at astronomical distances, allowing gravity to dominate. The number of negative and positively charged particles in the universe must therefore be equal to one another to better than 1 part in 10 to the 37th, probably better than 1 part in 10 to the 40th, in order for gravity to dominate. Even more striking is the balance between the gravitational force tending to pull things together and the expansion of the universe. Expansion of the universe is not, as far as we know, a force, but some type of a dynamic motion. And we don't know from inside the universe exactly how it got to have that. The expansion speed of the universe appears to be decreasing as it expands further. And so we can't give a number for it at all times in its history. And obviously gravitational force is decreasing as the particles move apart. There's a very nice balance between the two. We know that today the balance between the density of the universe, which produced the gravitational field pulling inward, and the expansion speed is within a factor of 10 of the critical value, which would be an exact balance between expanding forever on the one hand and falling, the universe falling back on itself and collapsing again on the other hand. Now, a factor of 10 doesn't sound like it's all that greatly tuned. But if you look at the situation and move back into history of the universe, back closer and closer to the Big Bang, you find that to be as close as a factor of 10 to the balance point now, you have to be very close as you go back to a tenth of the history of the universe. And in fact, the balance between expansion and gravity has to be accurate to one part in 10 to the 60th at just 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang in order to have a universe that survives like ours does. If you had the density one part in 10 to the 60th higher back then, the universe would have fallen back on itself very quickly, and there would never have been galaxies formed, there would never have been any stars formed, never been any planets formed, and presumably there would never have been any life. If this force were one part in 10 to the 60th, if the expansion speed was one part in 10 to the 60th larger, or the gravity one part in 10 to the 60th smaller, the universe would have expanded so rapidly there have been no galaxies formed, and again, no life. And as you work through these things, it has become very striking to the scientists who have thought about this, that it looks like we live in a designed universe. And scientist after scientist who have no theistic axes to grind have begun to wonder about this. How has this happened? And the best non-theistic explanation they can come up with is, well, if it hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here. And since we're here, it has to have happened. And that's all I need to tell you. As a scientific theory, that has got some very severe weaknesses. Whereas a theory that we have a designed universe very naturally explains things like this. If a designer is aiming for this result, he will do what's necessary to get that result if it's possible. And that may involve some very, very great fine-tuning. So the evidence from the nature of our universe points very strongly to the existence of God. So does the evidence that we have from the nature of life point very strongly to the existence of God. In the media, over the past 10 or 15 years, there's been a great deal of hassle over the creation-evolution controversy. We're not really going to get into that this evening, because whether or not evolution is the means by which the diversity of life that we have came to pass, it is apparent that there's some severe problems with a undirected evolution to explain what we've actually got. One of the biggest problems comes right at the beginning. The simplest kinds of life that we know anything about are enormously complicated. We can argue whether virus is life or not, but viruses, at least as they exist today, can't get along without other living things to poach off of, so to speak. Therefore, the simplest living things we've got that can get along by themselves are cells. And as Carl Sagan pointed out in his article on life in the last couple of editions of Encyclopedia Britannica, the simplest living cell has an information content equivalent to 100 million pages in the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's a lot of information. And in a sense, if one proposes that the universe has no mind behind it, you are saying that somehow that level of organization, not just of random figures, of organization, has been put together by random processes, finally. No matter what kind of principles you have to hold on to stuff and regularize stuff, to actually build up the order, we do not know of processes that will work. Obviously, mutation and natural selection is not going to work well until you've got self-reproducing things, living things. There have been some attempts to calculate what the simplest self-reproducing mechanism might be. I actually had a very small contribution in that myself. Ran across an article a couple of years ago in a journal on a person attempting to build a machine that would make a replica of itself. and the machine that the guy designed, an electronic machine that presumes the existence of an infinite or at least sufficiently large plane of electronic chips already hooked together that can be turned on and off the right way, already starts with a great deal of organization built in down at that level, but then asks, what kind of information do you need to make these chips work in a concerted way that a particular set of them will somehow make a set that's a duplicate of itself, that is, turn on a set that would be a duplicate of itself, and that duplicate then would turn on another set that would be a duplicate of itself, etc. And when you actually work out the calculations for the amount of information you need there, it's a lot less than 100 million pages in Encyclopedia Britannica, but it's a lot more than one can reasonably postulate has happened in a universe as big as our known part of the universe is, in a length of time equivalent to the time since the Big Bang. The calculation I did suggested that that it was far short of what was necessary. In a book by called The Blind Watchmaker, written some years ago by a fellow named Richard Dawkins, he suggested that we should believe that life started by itself on a planet if there was one chance in 10 to the 20th that life would start on a given planet like Earth in the history of the universe in 20 billion years. If there was one chance in 10 to the 20th, life would start on an Earth-like planet, because he thought there were probably 10 to the 20th Earth-like planets in our universe. Gets into a little trouble what an Earth-like planet is, but let's go with that. When you actually do this calculation for this self-reproducing automaton, it turns out there's 10 to the 100th power less chance of something like that self-organizing than there is for the than there is for this one chance in 10 to the 20th. So it's 100 orders of magnitude below the threshold which Dawkins set up. Suggestion then, the origin of life itself is a very strong pointer for organization, for a designer behind the universe. So too is the existence of the very complex, finely tuned organization that actually exists in living things. It is not hard to wave one's hands and talk about how the more fit types of plants, animals, etc., survive better in a particular environment. But when you begin to get down to the question of are they enough better to outcompete their other competitors and then replace the whole population with their kind and do that in such a way as to develop things like flying systems, vision systems, blood circulation systems, etc. You begin to get into some very, very hairy numbers that just do not look like they are going to work. My suggestion then, with a very brief tour of evidence from scientific matters, is that yes, there is a God. We live in a universe that has a mind behind it that indicates a designer and creator. The second question we wanted to examine is this God the God of the Bible? And here we turn to evidences that point to the God of the Bible. Obviously, already the evidence we've got that there's a being that's like a mind and that he is responsible for the universe and its organization, that's what the Bible claims that there is. But of course, other religions claim there's some such God as that, although it's actually rather rare to find a monotheistic religion that is not related to the Bible in some way or another. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Mormonism, various things of that sort. When we begin to look in the Bible, we find that God says, yes, I exist, and you don't just need to take a leap in the dark. I'm providing evidence that I exist. One of the principal forms of evidence that God provides in the Bible that exists, and by which he challenges other theologies, is the evidence of fulfilled prophecy. We spent some time last night over at Cornell talking about the evidence of fulfilled prophecy. It's interesting, for instance, that God has given through his prophets a number of predictions regarding the fates of many, many ancient cities. We looked at a whole sequence of pairs of cities, two of the largest Egyptian cities, Memphis and Thebes, and we pointed out that the Bible predicts on the one hand that Memphis will lose all its idols, its idols will be destroyed, but doesn't say anything about the people being destroyed. Whereas for Memphis, the Bible says the people will be destroyed, and doesn't say anything about the idols. When we sketch the history of what happened to Memphis and Thebes, we find out, of course, that both of them were invaded and taken and such several times in history, because that's characteristic of any city that survives for any long period of centuries. But the city of Memphis, the second of these two, was very severely decimated by one of the successors to Alexander the Great, and there has been no city on that site since that time. But archaeological investigation of the site finds idols all over the place in the city, whereas Thebes, I've got the names backward myself now, Memphis, up further north, we find the city was not wiped out as regards its population, though indeed it is now desolate, but the Muslims, when they took Egypt in the 600s, built a city about 10 miles away that they made capital city, and these people gradually moved over to the capital city. They used the ruins of Memphis as a quarry, and so recent excavations have found virtually nothing in the way of idols left at that particular site. A striking way in which that's fulfilled. We have a similar situation with regard to the two imperial capitals, Babylon, the capital of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. That picture is said of Babylon, it will be desolated forever, that no Arab will dwell there, that no sheep will graze there, and such. Whereas it says of Nineveh, that it will be destroyed, that sheep will graze there, and such. And that, in fact, is what we find about those two. Using them as a test against one another, a control for one another, as we use it in scientific lingo, we find you can't reverse the two and find that they've been fulfilled. I looked at several other examples of that sort. I looked at the example of Gaza and Ashkelon, looked at the example of Capernaum and Nazareth, and such, trying to show that indeed we have in Scripture real fulfillment of events before they came, came to pass centuries after the material was written down. A second line of evidence which the Bible gives is that the God of the Bible really can change people inside. That there is a real transformation of a society when the people trust in the God of the Bible. And indeed, that is something that has been seen both on an individual and a collective level again and again in history. And our society here in the United States shows some very, very good features about our society that are a result of even now the remnant of belief in the God of the Bible, the remnant of attitudes and features in our society as a result of the God of the Bible that are perhaps slowly wearing away as people decide they really don't like Christianity, but which have had a very, very positive influence in our society. With that very brief tour of some evidence from the Bible, I suggest that indeed the God who exists is the God of the Bible. We have a number of works down here that you would welcome to look into regarding other evidences for the God of the Bible, should you like to pursue that particular question further. Is there a God? Yes. Is he the God of the Bible? Yes. Is God loving? Well, it can depend somewhat on one's definition of love. If you define love so that one who loves will never under any circumstances allow suffering, then the God of the Bible is not loving. But that's not the Bible's definition of loving. And It doesn't even make a very good fit with what we understand to be the best way for humans to act as parents. A severe problem that many have had in this generation has been that parents have decided that if they're loving, they will not discipline their children. And their children grow up to be real brats or a great deal worse as a result of that. So there's been some revival in secular circles even of an emphasis on tough love. The need to see that if one really loves someone else, that you don't want to just let them go off and make a mess of their lives. A biblical definition of love is given in a very famous chapter in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 13. I just want to read several verses there, verses 4 through 7, that give us kind of a list of things that characterize love. Love is patient. Love is kind. It is not jealous. Love does not brag. It is not arrogant. It does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked. It does not take into account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. This is a biblical definition of love, and it definitely allows room for parental type of love. And I think the parental type of love is really the best model we have of understanding how God is loving. Like a parent, God is concerned to produce the right sort of person. And in order to do that, God must punish evil, and he must encourage maturity, encourage movement in the right direction. My suggestion then is that if we take biblical sense of loving, then the Bible consistently pictures God as loving. So, we try to answer a few questions here. Is there a God? Yes, I believe there's excellent evidence for that. Is he God of the Bible? Yes, there's excellent evidence for that. Is he loving? That's the way he's pictured in the Bible using biblical definition of love. That begins to bring us into now the question which we've titled this lecture. Why then is there suffering? And yet, we've already, in discussing the parental model as helpful in understanding love, begun to see some reasons why there might be suffering. First of all, there is a need to punish evil. So given that evil exists, just as parents might sometime have to discipline their children. Why? Because there appears to be something wrong with the child. So, God might do that. Sometimes a parent will do that through direct intervention. They will spank the child, or they will deprive the child of something the child likes in order to learn that they should not flaunt the authority of the parent. Sometimes the parent will do it in a different direction. They will allow the child to experience the bad consequences of the action to begin to learn that certain actions have certain consequences. And one trouble many parents have had is they have shielded their children so much from the consequences of action that when the children are out on their own, they're really not mature. They really do not know that their actions have consequences. That is a disastrous thing to do to one's children. There's the other side, too. A parent, in raising a child, needs to encourage maturity in the child. As the child begins to get older, the parents must gradually begin to let up on the control so that the child begins to make his or her own decisions. The parents have to gradually begin to let up on the protection so that the child begins to learn the consequences of his or her actions. The parents begin to gradually let up on the punishment so that the child will learn to do right for the right reasons. If a child only does right because he's afraid of getting punished by it, that child is really not morally mature. The child really needs to learn to do right because it's right. That suggests two reasons, then, why there might be suffering in this world. There's another possible reason, and that is, if God has chosen to set up a system of physical causality in this world, as it appears that he has, that in itself may produce suffering in a world of sinners. What do I mean by that? A world of physical causality is one in which if a certain physical thing is done, it quite invariably produces a certain physical result. If one sets a nail against a piece of wood and hammers on it, natural result is that there's a transfer of momentum and the nail begins to penetrate the wood. Same sort of thing when one lays an axe against a piece of wood, etc. And in a world of physical causality, the reasons why the person hits the nail on the head do not influence the result that the nail goes in. The reason that the person swings the axe does not influence the result of what the axe does. In a world designed in that way, if people do things for wrong motives, they can produce suffering very easily. If the nail you are driving in is closing a coffin around someone you have tied up who is still alive, a great deal of suffering will be produced. If the axe you are laying is to somebody's body instead of to a tree, suffering can very seriously result. You can see then, I think, that a world in which there's a system of physical causality will produce suffering if some of the causers, in fact, have bad motivations, intend to produce harm. I think then we can see that given the existence of evil, there will be suffering in the world as long as evil is allowed to operate freely. And perhaps there will be suffering somewhere as long as evil continues to operate at all. That brings us to the next question. Why is there so much suffering? There seems to be suffering that doesn't look obviously like it's about evil. There are earthquakes and floods, actions which used to be called in American jurisprudence, English jurisprudence, acts of God, and for which an occasional atheist has tried to sue a church because something or another happened. Don't believe any of those have made it through the court successfully. But and there are people who do things that seem to be mistaken or something that produce a great deal of suffering, and yet as best we can tell, they had fairly good motives, that sort of thing. Why is there so much suffering? Well, the Bible tells us one thing. Humans are a lot more sinful than they like to think. And humans cause an enormous amount of suffering. That doesn't deal directly with earthquakes yet, ever. But it's a passage in Luke chapter 13 that does seem to deal with those sort of things. In fact, it's probably been talking about an earthquake in one place. Luke chapter 13. Jesus is teaching a crowd. In fact, he's been talking about the judgment. He says, why don't you, even on your initiatives, judge what is right? While you're going with your opponent to appear before the judge, on your way there, make an effort to settle with him in order that he may not drag you before the judge, and the judge turn you over to the constable, and the constable throw you into prison. I say to you, you shall not get out of there until you've paid the very last cent. Jesus is picturing the coming judgment as kind of a civil suit in which you've got a case that won't stand up in court, and you better try and settle out of court, because if it goes into court, you are in trouble. Now, on the same occasion, here's what we're headed for, there were some present who reported him to both the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. We don't know much else about this, except Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea for a 10-year period surrounding the ministry of Jesus. And apparently, he had killed a number of Galileans who were in the midst of sacrificing animals in the temple. Perhaps he suspected some of them were terrorists. Perhaps they were innocent bystanders in an attempt to arrest or stop some terrorists. We don't know. We weren't there. The people apparently are concerned about what's going on there, why that suffering, and something of that sort. And perhaps it had entered their mind that the reason for the suffering was these guys were worse than other guys. Jesus shoots that down very quickly. He answered and said to them, "Do you suppose these Galileans were greater sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered this fate?" I tell you, no. Then the stinger. "Unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." That one obviously sets them back on their heels some. Then Jesus moves on to move out of the realm, because one could have said, well, Pilate was a nasty fellow. Or some Galilean terrorists were nasty fellows and these guys just got caught in the way. Now Jesus moves on to what we might call natural disaster, acts of God. "Do you suppose those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them were worse culprits than all the men who live in Jerusalem?" We don't know details about this, but we have a fair bit right there. Siloam is one of the parts of Jerusalem. A tower apparently fell on a bunch of people. The towers that were built in Jerusalem would likely have been stone towers. Perhaps it was an earthquake. Earthquakes are certainly somewhat more common there than they are right around this part of the eastern United States. It's always possible it was poorly built or something of that sort, but we're not really told. Tower fell on them. Do you suppose they were worse? I tell you, no. "But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." So he's twice given that refrain, which is kind of scary, and sounds like a threat, yes. What does it say about the problem of evil and the problem of suffering? Well, so far it's a statement. Now Jesus proceeds to give them a parable that justifies the statement. He began telling this parable. "A certain man had a fig tree, which had been planted in his vineyard, and he came looking for fruit on it, and didn't find any. And he said to the vineyard keeper, 'Look, for 3 years I've come looking for fruit on this fig tree without finding any. Cut it down. Why does it clutter up the ground?' The vineyard keeper answered and said to him, 'Let it alone, sir, for this year too, until I dig around it and put in fertilizer. And if it bears fruit next year, fine. But if not, then cut it down.'" What's going on in that parable? Well, the vineyard owner wants to cut down a fig tree because it's in a vineyard. It casts some shade in the vineyard, so obviously it reduces somewhat the productivity of the grapevines around it. It draws nutrients from the soil, and so reduces the fruitfulness of the grapevines around it. But it isn't producing any fruit. It is, if you like, using the environment, but not producing anything for it. The gardener agrees it ought to be cut down, but he's going to give it one more chance. He's going to dig around it, aerate it, put in some more fertilizer, and see if it produces anything. What does that have to do with the story? Great deal. According to biblical material, we're created by God. Suppose he had any purpose for creating us? The parable suggests he had a purpose fairly similar to what the owner of the vineyard had for having a fig tree planted in it. Namely, he wanted some kind of return. What kind of return do you suppose he wanted? Well, the Bible tells us what kind of return God would like from mankind. God would like humans to love Him with all our heart and mind and soul, not just because He likes to be loved, not because He's an egotist, but because He deserves it. We sometimes get excited when we read a novel by a good writer. We sometimes get excited when we hear an orchestral composition by a composer or done by an excellent orchestra. Or we sometimes get excited when somebody slam dunks a basketball at a crucial place in the game or catches the winning touchdown for our team in the Super Bowl or something like that. I'm a Washington Redskins fan. I saw them play 3 quarters last year. They were the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th quarters of the Super Bowl. I had a great season. I don't know about you guys. None of us, not one, is producing the kind of fruit we ought to be producing. None of us love God with all our heart and mind and soul. Probably never have at any point in our life. And the second commandment, which sounds a great deal easier, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, maybe we do that once in a while, but it doesn't last long. We're all fruitless fig trees, cluttering up the environment. God says, cut it down. Why should that person continue to mess up the environment? The vineyard owner, representing the mercy of God, I think that's what you really have here. The vineyard owner represents the justice of God. His gardener represents the mercy of God. He says, give one more chance. Every time we see a natural disaster, the people who are killed in that natural disaster, their chances are over. People who survive, the question ought not to be, why did these innocent people perish? The Bible says, look, if you apply God's standards, there aren't any innocent people. The question ought to be, why am I still here? And this parable gives the answer. You're getting another chance. You're getting another chance so that you might recognize where you stand with God and turn around and get straightened up with Him and make something out of your life. And we can't make much of our life ourselves, but if we'll turn our lives over to Him, He can make something out of our lives. Why is there so much suffering? Mankind is very sinful and produces an enormous amount of it on our own. Disaster is an advance warning of the wrath to come, which is given not for the benefit of the people who die in it, but for the benefit of the people who survive it. To recognize that when the last judgment comes, even if you're relatively the most righteous person in your generation, you still flunk. And you need to do something about it. Now there's an additional biblical explanation for why there's so much suffering in the world. And that's because mankind and God and His associates don't make up all the beings there are in the universe. The Bible teaches us that there's a being called Satan. Rather humorous idea in modern culture. You know, a little fellow in a red union suit who goes around trying to get people to sign contracts. It's not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is Satan's, yes, a created being. He's pretty far up in the upper echelon somewhere. We don't have details on it. A general guess has been maybe he's an archangel of some sort. He hates God. People can be smarter than any of us are and hate God. And people can be dumber than any of us are and love God. People can be smarter than any of us are and love God, and people can be dumber than any of us are and hate God. Your reaction to God is not basically an intellectual question. It's a moral question. It's a personal question. Why there's evil is in some sense a mystery we cannot answer. we can say this, that in some sense, God is the author of a great novel, which started the first time he created anything, and will run on forever. And one of the plots of that novel is what evil is all about, and how it operates, and what it produces, how foolish it is, and what grave consequences it has, both for those who are evil, and for those that they have contact with. There is a superhuman evil in the world that often throws people out of their calculations. Going back to the Holocaust, I remember an incident in the circle of things related to the Warsaw Ghetto. The Jews of Poland, as Nazi control took over there during World War II, were forced to move from wherever they were living into the Warsaw Ghetto, where a large number of them had been living anyway. They were not allowed to come out. And then they were told by the Nazis that we are going to transport you by rail to a new living area in the eastern part of Poland. And naturally, some of the Jews were suspicious about that. Some of them slipped out of the ghetto. There were connecting sewers running from the ghetto into other parts of Warsaw, slipped out, and found the railroad tracks, followed the tracks, watched the boxcars, etc., and found they were going to concentration camps with gas and ovens and such in the eastern zone. And they came back to the ghetto and told people what was happening. Many of the Jews could not believe it. It did not fit into their theology that mankind was that bad. Well, mankind is that bad, though I think it's probably fair to say he has some help, some unseen help. There is a superhuman evil in the world. It seems to surface with amazing regularity. Certainly Hitler is not the only example of it, even in our century. There have even been some examples that are pretty close to his, although they have not had a chance to run quite the scope since his time. Think of Paul, think of Idi Amin, etc. Biblical teaching very clearly is that this Satan, and he has some supporters in the unseen world, hate mankind, especially those who are doing good. The biblical teaching also is that this world is a war zone. We don't see the war going on with our eyes, but we see a lot of the consequences. We see the casualties of what is going on. Why is there so much suffering? Mankind is very sinful, producing considerable suffering ourselves. Disaster is God's advance warning for the survivors of the wrath to come, so that we might avoid that. And there is a superhuman evil in the world, not allowed to do anything that does not fit within the scope of God's novel. But the scope of God's novel allows evil to work itself out in some very strong ways. Why do babies suffer? I don't know. We've already suggested from what we've talked about, that there's an unseen world we don't know what's going on in. The book of Job is an excellent illustration of that. Job had disasters come on him that looked like acts of God. A tornado tore up the house and killed his kids. Fire fell from heaven, don't know whether it was supernatural looking or whether it was lightning, and killed some of his herds. Some more of his herds, and that was his main wealth. Living in an area that was a herding area, was taken or destroyed by marauders. And yet, when we look behind the scenes, when we see what the Bible is telling us about what's going on, we find out that all of those events are actually persecution. Not by some neighbors that hated Job's righteousness, but by Satan, who hated Job's righteousness. Why did God allow that to happen in this particular case? We have information about it. What's that? Satan had suggested that Job only served God because of all the good things God gave him. And so, God allowed Satan to take those good things away so that Satan eventually found out, but if you read the end of the story, never admits, that indeed Job served God because of who God was, something that perhaps would even have surprised Job at the beginning of the story, and not because of what he could get out of it. It's not unfair to think that that sort of thing is happening again and again in our world even now. What about the babies again? Well, we don't know all the answers there. We'd like to know some answers there. There are parents who have had babies suffer and die and who wondered why. They don't know. We do have a rather interesting principle given in Scripture, however. It's found over in the last chapter of the Gospel of John. Jesus has just restored Simon Peter by asking him three times if he loved Jesus, because three times Peter had denied that he even knew Jesus. And Peter is deeply grieved by that. But he says, finally, Lord, you know me. You know what I'm like inside. You know that I love you. Then Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to dress yourself, walk where you wished. But when you grow old, you'll stretch out your hands. Someone else will dress you and bring you where you do not wish to go. Rather cryptic statement, although it's obviously a prediction of some sort. The Apostle John, writing after Simon Peter's death, looking back on the event, says, Jesus said this, signifying by what kind of death Peter would glorify God. The stretching out of the hands he takes apparently to a reference to crucifixion in a rather cryptic way. And when he had spoken this, Jesus says to Peter, follow me. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. Appears to be the Apostle John from the context. Peter, therefore, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Jesus said, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Basic answer, none of your business, Peter. Rather interesting feature here. If we're old enough to worry about what happens to babies, we aren't babies. If we believe the Bible is God's word, and there's excellent evidence for it, we can trust God with this. Abraham asked God, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And God doesn't say, tough luck, I'm the boss here, I'm going to do it my way. No. The judge of all the earth will do right. Because in addition to God's love, a very important characteristic of God is his righteousness. So we don't know the answers to why babies suffer, but we do know that when it all works out, at the judgment, everything else, God will have been vindicated as having done right, though he has not told us in detail why or wherefore in that particular case. I want to try and wrap this up then, at this point. It's not wrong that we should be concerned about suffering. It's not wrong that we should wonder at times why God, loving, allows so much suffering as he does in the world. But there's kind of a practical application to this whole sort of thing. Obviously, one of the features which God has called us to is to help relieve suffering. Not only not to cause suffering ourselves, except as would fall within our responsibilities as parents, as perhaps policemen or judges or things of that sort, but that we should go about doing good, redeeming. And one of the characteristics of Jesus' ministry to show us what God himself was like was the way he went around and healed people, the way he went around even and raised the dead, the way he went around and brought forgiveness to people. We ought to ask this question. What am I doing to relieve suffering? What am I doing to to relieve suffering. There are many, many people who seem to be greatly concerned about this, but don't think much at all about the idea that, well, we should kill unborn children if the mothers don't want to have them. Will that finally, in the judgment, wash out to be much better than what Hitler was doing in the ovens, in the gas chambers? The Bible's right about what this universe is all about. There's something worse than suffering in this life. And that is that we might die, and when we stand before God, it would turn out that we aren't acceptable before Him. Well, people look around and say, well, I'm not as good as I should be, but I'm better than Him. So with the cutoff line is between Him and me, we'll be all right. And what if it's up here? Well, tough luck. The Bible gives us some hints on that already. Very, very common in many religions in the world have sort of the balance scale thing. The judgment, your good deeds are going to be put over here, and your bad deeds are going to be put over here. See which one's heavier. And it's, you know, it comes out, the good deeds are a little better than the bad deeds, you're okay. Not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is the wages of sin. What sin deserves is death. The gift of God is eternal life. That every one of us recognizes when we think about it that we don't love God with all our heart or mind or soul. We don't love our neighbors or self. Some of us could care less that God exists. And we're going to make a mess of our lives. How will we answer the judgment? The Bible says there's only one way we can stand at the judgment, and that's in something that God Himself did. He says to sinners, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Why will you die? But God is righteous. He cannot overlook sin. All sin needs to be paid for. But God Himself was willing to suffer and to die as a human, because God Himself can't die, in order to pay for sin. That's what the whole biblical story about the coming of Jesus, about His being the God-man, why is that necessary? That God Himself might come and live a life of perfect human righteousness, so if we trust in Him, that righteousness will be put to our account. That He might suffer on the cross in a few hours, a suffering that would take us forever to suffer. Why should I suffer forever, you say? I only did this and this and this and this. And this and this and this and this and this and this and this. But it's still a finite amount. Because I'm only going to live 75 or 80 or 95 or 65 or 55 or 25 years. Right. But the little bit of information we have about hell, we don't have a whole lot, by the way. And there's been a great deal of imagination that has worked since. Dante's Inferno, we'll show you some of that. It goes way beyond anything in the Bible, okay? But the little bit we've got shows this fellow, the rich man, in the story of the rich man and Lazarus, still sinning. Hell is apparently not God. God cares enough about us that He was willing to suffer that we might not have to suffer. And that's the offer He sets out for you tonight. Why is there so much suffering? Because evil is loose in the world, but God has overcome evil. And can help us so that we will one day no longer be evil. And give us something we couldn't earn ourselves. I'm going to come back and answer some questions, or try and answer some questions, in a few minutes here. But before I do that, Jennifer has some remarks to make and some announcements to make.
really need the questionnaires, like I said before, and Michael, I think you're fine. Oh, it fell down. Whoops. You can put them underneath the TV set there on that, like, shop. And that would be really appreciated. To tell you about what's coming up, if you'd like to hear Dr. Newman some more, I know I would. He is going to be speaking tomorrow morning at the Faith Bible Church, which is right here in Endicott. It's only located 10 minutes from Cornell. If you need a ride can be provided for you. There's a service at 10 a.m. tomorrow, and the talk is going to be concerning what about those who have not heard. And the talk at 11 a.m. right after that will be, can you really know God? Dr. Newman's going to be speaking. I'm sure they're going to be excellent. Also, the following week, which would be the weekend of the 16th, 17th, and 18th, Mr. Robert Manderson is coming to speak at Faith Bible Church also at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, September 16th, at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, September 17th, at 10 a.m. Sunday, September 18th, 11 a.m. Sunday, September 18th, and 7 p.m. Sunday, September 18th. I know you can't remember all that, so we have a seat for you. So, stop down. We do have literature down here, more books. Some of them are by Dr. Newman and other various authors. And we're happy to answer your questions, and we look forward to seeing you at ICCF. Thank you very much for coming tonight, and afternoon we'll address any of your questions.
Okay, we made that break, so if anybody needs to escape, they can do so. I don't want to prolong this question-and-answer session unduly, but I do want to try and make an attempt at answering any questions you've got. And if you think it's going to be a long, complicated thing of some sort that only you might be interested in, we can get together and talk about it afterwards. I'll try and be around here for a while afterwards. But if you think it's of general interest, I certainly would like to make an attempt to answer it. So, go to it. Yes, sir.
One of the main points that seemed to me on the existence of God was that our universe as we know it is designed to support the life that we know and our life forms that we see.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't account for unknown life forms.
Yeah, obviously it does not. In fact, the Bible would suggest that there are certain kinds of unknown life forms that our part of the universe perhaps was not even particularly designed for. That's what the angel,
exactly.
Satan sort of thing. So obviously we can't talk just about, we can start wandering at waving hands. What's rather striking is a number of the features, you really wouldn't have a universe at all, hardly. So it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about carbon-based life or whether you imagine some silicon-based life or germanium-based life or something, you still would be in a bind on those sort of things. But basically, a point I'm suggesting is, and I've developed this a little bit, rather short sketch in this little thing here called A Designed Universe with some footnotes and such, if you want to try and pursue it further. Okay, go ahead. Further in the direction now.
Even what you just said now, that it may not have had a universe if it wasn't designed. But we don't know any other type. And there's no definite way of saying it.
Yeah. The striking feature about this particular kind of argument is we know that you can change some of the variables a very small amount, and you don't get any kind of universe that functions. And I try and develop a little bit of that in there. Okay, we still don't know the question of whether our three-dimensional universe with time is all there is or not. And in fact, I think there's some more, I believe there's some more dimensions around this, but that is getting pretty far out. So let's wander back from there. Okay, further questions on the suffering matter. Yes, sir.
So, what are your analogies on how you view the Father created heaven? No matter how old the child is, being a parent, you are always a parent. And if the child does something wrong, no matter what age, and the parent is still around, the parent will always intervene, just a feeling of being a parent, to try to help correct what the child has done wrong. But as an older adult, he's no longer a child, granted, but the parent is still a parent. So whether the child is 60 and the parent 70, and the first thing goes out and does something wrong, the parent will say, well, did you really think about that? So how, in that analogy, would you explain God letting the wars that have gone on go on for so long without intervening and saying, hey, wait a minute, you're messing up here, try to get back on track?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I'd go with 1680 or something like that. Sorry. I say things like that when I'm talking to you. Okay. One. Again and again, we want to call on God to intervene, but when we actually analyze it, we want God to intervene without doing something about us. And God does, of course, suggest, as we saw in that parable of the fig tree in the vineyard, that as far as taking away people by death and disaster, etc., He does in fact intervene again and again. Forgot the name of that historian, British historian, in the work Christianity and History, Herbert Butterfield, suggests indeed that it looks to him like there are a number of places where things have happened in history that were some kind of God's, what we might call providential intervention. Now, God clearly tells us that He is going to intervene in a much stronger sense at the second coming of Jesus, etc., or at the destruction of the world and its replacement by new heavens and new earth and such. But at that point, that kind of calls a halt to the whole thing. And in a sense, we've got an analogy in the book of Job. God does not intervene in Job's favor until He has allowed the question that Satan raised, does Job serve God for nothing, look at all he's getting out of it, etc., until God's taken away everything. Not only the wealth, the kids, the support of his wife, etc., but what's often missed in the book of Job is that that contest goes on all the way up to the end when Job repents and says, I really didn't know what I was talking about. I have now seen you. You're way beyond what I thought. God goes beyond perhaps even what Satan had suggested in order to show that Job doesn't serve God for the support of his friends. Job doesn't serve God because he can out-argue them. Job doesn't serve God because God pats him on the back. And finally, when it becomes apparent, God having come face to face, and Job not having cursed him to his face, even though God rebukes him for various things, finally, Job's lost everything and repents. Then the test is over, and God intervenes, and God, not being a cheapskate, rewards Job for what it is. Though Job served God for nothing, God is not going to let Job finally serve him for nothing. Right? I think we've got that kind of thing going on in human history as well. And so, yes, there are judgments in human history. Yes, Hitler's pass off the scene. Some very wicked people manage to either kill themselves or get themselves killed by other people at various points. But the play hasn't run its course yet. The contest isn't over yet. And when it's over, then He will intervene. So He does intervene in a providential way, to use theological terminology. That is, working through what look like natural events, more or less. But He only would rarely intervene in a supernatural, sign from heaven sort of way. And the real intervention of that sort will be to call a halt to the whole thing. So that's how I would see the thing. Now, I obviously can't answer all your questions because it's a big universe now in the Revelation regarding the thing. But that's how I would see it structured, that particular problem. Okay, further questions? Last chance for a public question. Private questions open in time, of course. Yes, sir, go ahead. Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, just to point out, you're a religious person yourself.
I believe in the God of the Bible. I believe that I'm not good enough to stand in the judgment, but that Jesus is good enough to stand in my place in the judgment. I'm trusting Him. I don't know all the answers. I've been very, very pleased that God has done things to me that I'm better than I was, that I love him more than I used to, that as I work through the scriptures, I come to see him as bigger and bigger and bigger each time. I don't know if you've ever read the little book by C.S. Lewis, his series, The Narnia Chronicles, children's stories, etc. In one of them, it's probably the Voyage of the Dawn Treader or something, the little girl says to the lion who represents Jesus in the story, "Oh, Aslan, you're so much bigger." He says, "As you grow older, I'll grow bigger." J.B. Phillips said something of the same thing in one of his books. Your God is too small. Our God who exists is not too small. But our picture of him is too small. But Lord willing, as we grow older and as we understand things more, our picture of God gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but it never gets bigger than he is. That's where I am. Okay.
The point is, I can also do scientific study on having a new dream success. Do you not understand how to word this? I'm not really sure.
Go ahead. Give it a try.
Because you're religious and you believe in God and being scientific and have a scientific point, don't you see yourself as just by making a stand on this, you are biased in whatever you relate to us and how you see the things just by being religious yourself, you're being biased to the situation of what you're trying to report on?
Oh, everybody's got a point of view, okay? And in that sense, we're all biased. Everybody should make an attempt to deal fairly with the evidence. I'm not infallible. I have been very much impressed by the evidence. There have been plenty of times where I could have abandoned the religious point of view, and there have been some times when there's been some pressure put on it. When I took required religion courses at Duke University in my sophomore and junior year, there was some pressure put on it. But as I began to look around, I noticed that this particular view, we'll call theological liberalism, it's a characteristic of many of our mainline Protestant denominations, has a big influence on the Roman Catholic Church. They really weren't giving people anything to live for. And then as I begin to look at their evidence wasn't nearly what it's cracked up to be. So, yeah, there's some things going on there. Now, obviously, having worked through those things, I've gotten to a certain position, and that's what I talk from. What can you do? I mean, I could pretend to be an atheist and talk from their position, etc. But there's only so much time, and you guys are doing pretty well at this hour and 20 minutes we're here on already. I saw someone nodding a few minutes ago, but I won't say which direction or anything. My suggestion there, go listen to the atheists. Come listen to the Christians. Compare the evidence. Pay attention to evidence. And make a choice. And if you make the right choice, you get the benefits, even if you make it for somewhat crummy reasons. If you make the wrong choice, you get the disbenefits. You know, a person might carefully analyze all the stresses on the bridge and walk out on it, and it turns out that the bridge caves in on him anyway. And a person might just kind of blindly walk across the bridge, but if the bridge is strong enough, it'll be supported. No, we do need to care about epistemology. But it's what's underneath that really counts. And what the epistemology is to try and zero in on where it is. And that's what I'm trying to help you guys do. And you're welcome to go talk to the others as well. Okay. Yes, sir.
I'm going to carry that one step further and ask you, if you're being a Christian, affect the quality of the evidence there is in favor of Christianity and in favor of God existing in the universe. In other words, does that perspective to you make the evidence more weighty than the perspective of someone who's not already a Christian? Or is the evidence such that anyone from any background can look at it and be persuaded that yes, Christianity is true and that God's life is the nature of God?
I've been more and more impressed as I've studied it that the evidence is sufficiently strong that if a person really wants to know the answer to the question, it's adequate. Okay. However, humans being what we are, you know that if we have a strong desire to have something come out a certain way, we may decide we want more evidence. This is a human trait in general. I kind of like to think that when I'm eating in the line of duty, the calories don't count. But they do. I kind of like to think that after I've decided a peanut butter sandwich has 95 calories, that if I put twice as much peanut butter or a bigger piece of bread, I still count 95 calories and I go on my diet. So I'm not sure. Okay. So there can be pressures within us and from outside us that make us want to do funny things with the evidence. I'm satisfied the evidence is very strong. In fact, I've been impressed in recent years and working with this anthropic principle stuff that we discussed here in this little pamphlet and such, evidence stronger than I thought it was. So that's really where I'd come back to the thing. Yeah?
Could you give us some examples, since you've spoken about some of this literature, to point out what, other than what you briefly covered early on in the talk, is available, what avenues of pursuit of evidence are available?
Oh, well, let's see. We'll go over and take a look at some of the material here. Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Reliability of the Bible, Confirmation of Historical Text, Confirmation by Archaeologists. Archaeology. Jesus. We really haven't done much of anything with Jesus in our discussion here. The historical material regarding him has been a continuing problem for historians who don't believe in the supernatural. And they've had to get into rather elaborate plot theories to get around that kind of material. Messianic prophecies, the Old Testament fulfilled in Jesus Christ. I don't think I got into any of those tonight. I did get into some of them last night as well. Evidence of knowledge of medicine in Scripture, way beyond comparable material from antiquity, is in this book, None of These Diseases, by S.I. McMillan. This is probably the most detailed work around today on fulfilled prophecy, a book called The Wonders of Prophecy, done about the turn of the century by John Urquhart. Some friends and I are putting together another book of that sort, which we hope will be out within a month or so now, finally. We've been working on it for about 10 years and having trouble finding publishers and all of that. There's some material on fulfilled prophecy in The Science Speaks, which I helped another fellow revise a couple editions of. This Genesis 1 and the origin of the earth here is a discussion of a correlation between the scientific material regarding the origin of planet Earth and its early history and the biblical material. An area that's really a problem for many, many people who think that somehow the Bible teaches the earth was created in 4004 BC and running, etc., and that doesn't seem to fit science. And we suggest that, no, indeed, the Bible does not give us any such data of that sort. We discuss biblical passages and biblical material, and there is, in fact, a rather nice correlation there. Here's John Wark Montgomery's History and Christianity, which deals with some of the same sorts of things that Butterfield's work does. There's several other works over here. That's kind of the general sort of thing. I think that was a plant for a little advertisement of the literature. Let's quit with that. Thank you, sir.